you're listening to a special recording of the Pod Delusion, live at QEDCon 2013. Unfortunately, we weren't able to plug in directly to their sound system because of the changeover between events was very, very tight, but we have got an ambient recording and it is fairly good quality and it is full of interesting things, so do stay tuned to hear some of our regulars and some new people say some interesting things. You can find out more about the Pod Delusion at poddelusion.co.uk, but you already know that. So let's hand over to me a few days ago at QED.
It's April 2013. We're live at QED 2013. It's the Pod Delusion. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up over the next 50 minutes or so, we've got seven interesting speakers who will be telling us about some interesting things. We're looking forward to talking about autism and vaccines, the Alpha Course, sharks, blasphemy, spaceflight, celebranting, which is a thing, and probably not a verb, and possibly the history of science. So, without further ado, let's start with our first interesting thing, so I can stop talking, and let's listen to Therese, who's been talking about something very topical, and I suspect will make you very angry. Here's Therese with more.
Some of you might know that I do a talk about autism and quack therapies for it, and within that talk I do briefly mention vaccines as a purported cause for autism, but we know that's not the case. And historically, in order to fit my talk into the Skeptics in the Pub format 45 minutes, my slide on the MMR situation has been quite curt. It simply reads MMR, I'm sick of MMR. I then go into a bit of a rant about MMR should never have been part of the dialogue when it comes to etiology of autism. But I might have to change my talk a little bit because it's a blisteringly hot topic, as we know. It's even on the front page of The Independent today, and there's a big double page spread on page 4. I saw a tweet by writer James at 2:45, so not that long ago, said, wait, you're saying someone who lied and distorted data 15 years ago hasn't changed his mind or said anything new? Stop the goddamn presses. MMR is a vaccine intended to prevent measles, mumps and rubella. I could rehash the story of how discredited former Dr. Andrew Wakefield and his unethical studies on children and how he wanted to peddle single vaccinations. But if you're unaware of this, I recommend Daryl Cunningham's comics, and I'll ask James to put that in the show notes. The media frenzy surrounding his study results has, without a doubt, clearly influenced this conversation around autism and vaccines in general. And unfortunately, the British propaganda slogan, careless talk costs lives, is true in cases where journalists take a story like this and run with it for years and years and years. And even in January this year, we had a story in the Daily Mail with the headline, American parents awarded £600,000 in compensation after their son developed autism as a result of the MMR vaccine. Now, this is an exceedingly misleading headline, and given the article itself actually acknowledges that the decision doesn't apportion blame or even lay fault for the child's condition with the actual vaccine, I think this is a ridiculous headline. But the problem is, what many parents don't realise is that measles is highly infectious and can lead to blindness and death and all kinds of other disabilities. Most people, since the measles vaccination was introduced in the UK, haven't actually seen a child suffer because we did have herd immunity or community immunity, which I've seen going around today. And whooping cough is another really deadly illness, with 5 children dying in 2012. These are children who are too young to have had the vaccine, which normally happens at 13 months old. Between January and June 2012, there were 2,466 confirmed cases of whooping cough. Now, 12 years since Wakefield's study was first published, we're now seeing the deadly... No, it's not 12 years, is it? It's much longer ago than that. We're seeing an increase of measles cases. And in Swansea, at the time of writing yesterday, 693 children have been infected. As Sarah Deaton wrote in The Guardian on Monday, with measles cases so low, it was easy to forget what the vaccines were protecting us from. The illnesses sounded almost picturesque, vintage diseases from the 50s. It was as difficult to imagine as the taste of Spam. Now, in February 2012, the Cochrane Library published a systematic review called Vaccines for Measles, Mumps and Rubella in Children. They were trying to assess the effectiveness and adverse effects associated with MMR in children up to 15. And they searched and they found 5 randomised control trials, controlled clinical trial, 27 cohort studies, 17 case control studies, 5 time series trials, and a case crossover trial. And they concluded that exposure to MMR was unlikely to be associated with autism. And then last week we had the Centre for Disease Control in the US releasing a new study that confirmed what we already have enough evidence to assert with good confidence levels, that those with ASD or autism spectrum disorders are no more likely to have had more JAPs than anybody else. And Frank Stefano, who's the lead author on that CDC study, said that his study of 1,000 children simply found no relationship between vaccine antigens and ASDs. So why does this continue? Why must children suffer from ignorance? Conspiracy theories are really attractive, unfortunately, in grieving parents who haven't yet come to terms with their child's differences, differences they never anticipated, will grab onto anything to take away the blame. It's cathartic to suggest that an outside agent, the government or pharmaceutical companies, are to blame. And to put this into context, these are the same people who told the National Autistic Society in May 2012 that 74% of them received no help at all. 28% of them have said that they received good information to go where to go for support and help. So the 72% who get no help and information are the ones that are sucked into alternative medicines that are really, really harmful a lot of the time, and it's certainly expensive. And then they'll end up with a more ill, frightened and traumatised child and a lot lighter wallets. So if you can, tell just one parent about the vaccine scare and the truth behind it. Tell them vaccines are rigorously tested, and if they really want to know about vaccines, they should read a book on the history of them and how they're developed, and not just do a bit of Googling and call it research. The websites about vaccines seem so plausible and are pseudoscientific enough to give them a real air of credibility, but a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. This has been Tanita Pendergrass reporting live at QEDCon for the Pod Delusion.
Thank you very much. It's an important issue. It really makes you think. I mean, whilst yes, there are worthy campaigns trying to get, there's a campaign against, say, Page 3 trying to get topless women off of Page 2 for certain, yet the Independents are happy to put a dick on Page 1. Satire, everyone. So let's move swiftly on, and now let's hear from Sean Ellis. Sean, everyone.
Hi everyone. A couple of weeks ago, I got into one of those periodic debates with creationists on Twitter. Doesn't happen very often. And as it goes, this was fairly polite. But then an interloper asked me an interesting question. "Hey, Mr. Know-it-all evolutionist," he started. "If evolution always improves things, how come no creatures can fly into space? Hey, got you there, eh, haven't we? Ah!" I may be paraphrasing. But my initial reply, which was, seemed somehow lacking. So I decided to have a look at it. Although nothing on Earth can fly into space under its own steam, it's a fairly common theme in science fiction. The bugs in the Starship Troopers movies could shoot projectiles up to orbital height. James White's Sector General series had a rather weird barnacle-like life form that took over giant birds and jet-propelled them out of the away from their home planet, which was a bit weird. And Lemmy even had these things called stage trees, which secrete rocket fuel in the core of their trunk, and they usually use it like a firework to disperse their own seeds. But when a seed hits a particularly fertile spot, it grows into a giant multi-stage interstellar variant. And the living spaceship is almost a science fiction cliché these days. However, all of these are to some extent designed by intelligences, rather than evolving naturally. Even the stage trees were genetically engineered. So could something actually evolve that would get into space? Let's examine the options. Plants evolved motion for spreading seeds, and animals move for predation, escape, or mating. So let's have a quick look at the animals first. There is precedent for the escape side of the equation. Flying fish and the newly documented flying squid, which I urge you to look up if you haven't seen it already, skip out of their natural environment for short periods to avoid predators who can't follow them. So to them, leaping from the water into the air must be like going into a vacuum. Could birds do this? If you hop up into the thin air to escape from a predator, that might work. The predators would then evolve to pursue them, you get an arms race, and eventually you have a bunch of suborbital flying fish type of things. The trouble here is energy. Because a flying squid flies at about 10 metres a second, a little faster than Usain Bolt runs. For a half kilo squid, this is about 25 joules of kinetic energy, which is not much. To get up to orbital speed, or even suborbital speed, you need something like a million times as much. The highest flying birds don't go much above 8 kilometres, and they get there gradually. So hopping up to the arbitrarily defined 100 kilometre interspace line would require so much extra effort that it's better to conserve energy and run the risk of being eaten. As for predation, the archerfish, again, air-to-water thing, fires missiles of water from its natural river habitat to dislodge insects from the nearby leaves at the water's edge. But even with a fast missile, there's not actually that much to eat in the stratosphere, at least not until the invention of the airline meal. And that tends to come sturdily wrapped in a jet airliner. So, birds seem to be trapped at the bottom of our gravity well by lack of a meal and lack of a viable escape strategy. As for mating, again, the advantages of stratospheric sex are pretty much non-existent, especially if you've been in an airline twin. So perhaps there's a different way, storing up energy and releasing it quickly. I mean, some plants already do this on a small scale, gradually accumulating energy as tension in their structures, which they then use to fling seeds away from their parent plant. So how far could a plant hurl a seed, and how fast? You can imagine a small, dense seed and an enormous lever arm that would act as a trebuchet, but this isn't even going to get near orbital speed, and there are a couple of other factors against it. First of all, you need to invest energy again, enormous amounts of energy, and if you do that, you can create fewer seeds. Secondly, if you're a successful plant, then you are pretty much by definition in a place that's actually quite nice. And if you throw your seeds too far, they might end up in a nasty barren spot, and this isn't an advantage. And that, I think, is the general problem, because Earth is a very small, fertile spot in a vast expanse of barren wilderness. The nearest possible fertile spot is years away, if you count Mars, and millions of years if it's a different solar system. The reward for getting your seeds off the planet is dead seeds. To use one of Richard Dawkins' metaphors, it's not in the audience, I can mangle this as much as I like that. We're an isolated needle-thin peak on Mount Improbable, surrounded on all sides by a vast cliff leading down to the uninhabitable vacuum. The only way off the peak is by a huge leap across a gulf of nothingness to an equally tiny peak which we don't even know exists. There's no gradual gradient from one peak to the next, no nice easy path down the side and up the other end across the abyss of space. And so with no gradient, we won't see any evolution. What you need for this is saltation, a step change in the design of the life form. But as the size of the change grows, the probability of it happening decreases exponentially. And for a step as big as interstellar travel, it's essentially impossible. The lack of naturally space-capable species is more of an argument against ID than against evolution. Successful conquering of space requires something else. Maybe we've missed something. A process which isn't evolutionary at all. So far I've been talking about macroscopic organisms. But what about bacteria? They could easily hitch a ride on a meteorite. And this is probably the most plausible idea behind panspermia. But for the purposes of the original question, being at the right distance from an asteroid impact to be blasted off the surface of the planet isn't really an evolutionary strategy. All of my fictional examples required some kind of intelligent design. So could we genetically engineer something that can grow into a space-capable creature? Personally, I like the stage tree model. Trees have hundreds of years to accumulate enough fuel to get into orbit, and they can grow very large in a way that no animal ever could. Finally, there's a sort of anthropomorphic argument that we are the seeds. We've evolved into a space-capable species, so it's up to us. We should take up life's baton and spread beyond the surly bonds of Earth. If we succeed, And if there's life out there already, it's a better watch out. We're not good at keeping ourselves to ourselves. But if we destroy ourselves first, here's a tip. Keep an eye on bombardier beetles over the next billion years. This is Sean Ellis, trying to evolve away off the planet for the Pod Delusion.
Out of this world. It's a good job the space race wasn't based on biology, unless we, you know, really slow. But anyway, let's move swiftly on, as time is against us. And next up, we've got Simon Clare, who's going to be talking about the Alpha Course. I know, those weird Christians going to regular meetings where they discuss ideas and then going away for like a weekend retreat together. Ugh. Anyway, here's Simon Clare with more.
Thank you very much. The Alpha Course is used by the Christian Church to teach people about the basics of Christianity. It's aimed primarily at 18 to 35 year olds and acts both as a refresher for existing believers and as instruction for people new to the faith. Over a 9-week period, we are taught what it means to be a Christian. The course runs all over the world, and it's claimed by the organisers that 20 million people have attended it since it began in 1977. Its growth across Asia is remarkable. In India alone, the number of courses available in 2007 was just 100, and today there are 20,000 of the courses available over there. It's going down rather well. Across the world, there are about 66,000 Alpha courses. And in the UK, in any given town, you're likely to find between 6 and 10 courses running in each year. There'll be one a stone's throw from wherever you live. So what's the point of me sharing these figures with you? So what if the old church is implementing a way of spreading the word that reaches waverers while reinforcing the beliefs of devout followers? Well, wouldn't we love it if skeptics in the pub had anything like this ubiquity, or just a fraction of it? There are around 50 skeptics in the pub groups convening each month around the UK, with a few groups emerging elsewhere on the planet too. How can skeptics in the pub even hope to compete with the Alpha Course if each denomination in each town has a course available? Now, I use the word competition on purpose there. Some of you may balk at the idea of skeptics in the pub being in competition with the Alpha Course, but hear me out. You've probably heard that the Alpha Course teaches the basics about Jesus, why we should worship and follow him, and that it teaches us about God and how we can have a relationship with him and actually hear him guiding us. But you might not have heard so much about the later stages of the course, but they venture into the realm of the supernatural, the miraculous, and the properly woo. On the residential weekend, which forms an integral part of the course, the participants are induced into singing in tongues. That is, they are taken through a deliberate process, at the end of which some people will sing in tongues because God, the creator of the universe, is there in the room, actively validating the cult leader, I mean the trusted, honourable speaker. By filling members of the audience with an urge to go the person is validated. That is, the speaker is validated. He can call upon God to make you do these noises, and therefore God is on his side. The person inducing these manifestations is, of course, an honourable man, trusted by his congregation. They lend their ears as trusting friends would, and they are shown that God is in the room, and inside their very bodies, no less. The morning after this, any attendees that might not have directly felt the Holy Spirit are encouraged to describe any dreams they had that night, in case there might be messages there from God, and perhaps individuals in the audience might understand what the dreams mean if they share them with them. So, I had a dream about feet last night. Anyone got feet? We all know what's going on there, but for those on the Alpha Course, prophetic dreams are real. We would instantly identify such things as the basic tricks of stage psychics, but when they are presented on the Alpha Course, nobody dissents. Nobody expresses doubt. There are no skeptics there to ask where the evidence is or to present a different interpretation of what is being witnessed. The people describing their dreams and the people describing words of knowledge from God are not insincere in what they say. They are encouraged to believe their random dreams and idle thoughts might have some significance if they could only be shared with enough people. In a room of 300 people, the chances are that they will resonate with at least one of them. And what more evidence would they need? Having witnessed the mastermind of the International Alpha Course himself, Mickey Gumbel, hosting the evening where the audience are induced into believing the Holy Spirit is possessing them, I'm happy to declare that the methods he uses are indistinguishable from those used by stage psychics. You can check all this out for yourself if you like. The Alpha Course provides scripts for all of their sessions. The scripts include all the anecdotes you need, and they even include scripted fibs, such as only last week someone here started speaking Arabic or Russian, whichever language they choose. A scripted fib, that is. So the Crystal Land, an ostensibly trustworthy organisation, the Anglican Church, is promoting the idea that magic is real, that prayers can heal, and that God can talk to you through your dreams or through the dreams of others. Anecdotes of prophecies foretold and of short legs being miraculously restored to their true length abound. So when you go home, search on the Alpha Course website for how many courses are running near to you. They are all actively promoting this stuff, as if it was a normal everyday thing. Now, our ragtag band of a few dozen pub groups meeting once a month seems insignificant in the face of the well-organised and seductive force of the Alpha Course. The Alpha Course has centuries of church wealth accumulation behind it. If a church wants to put on an Alpha Course, they just do it. The premises are free and the content is scripted and available on DVD. The Alpha Course has evolved over the years to become a highly efficient, self-replicating presence, and it's growing even as I speak. While sceptics sit and argue with each other on the internet, some being not so far away from you is being told that dreams can be prophetic and that God can speak to them, that God's Holy Spirit can possess them. Someone with questions about the universe and their place in it is getting answers from someone who assures them that there is certainly an afterlife, that morality comes from God, and that prayer and faith could heal them. But yes, our arguments on the internet are terribly important. So, unless we're happy for this course to grow and spread across our towns and around the world unhindered, we must ask ourselves what we can do about it. Skeptics have a sad tendency to stop thinking as soon as they find one good reason for not doing something. If we are as clever as we say we are, we can keep on thinking until we find one good reason to do something. But what can we do? One of the most laudable traits of the Alpha Course is that it invites everybody to attend and to ask any question they want. I tested this. I was welcomed warmly by the vicar, and I asked all the questions, and I was not kicked off the course. Knowing that we are all invited to take part in the course, isn't it strange that we don't take them up on that invitation? It is understandable. It does take effort. We disagree with their message. The people on the course are deluded. Someone is wrong on the internet. Fair enough. I suggest that we take up the invitation and use the course's own infrastructure to spread a bit of scepticism. They provide us with a venue, with an audience, and with an open discussion format. We are few, but even having one sceptic present at each Alpha Course means that the other people on that course would get to hear what we have to say. In my experience on the course, a lot of people are simply unaware of godless morality or how evolution works. They just don't know. All we have to do is make ourselves available so that when a question is asked, we can graciously listen to the Christian answers and then let them know our reasons for not accepting them. You don't have to be abrasive to do this. With practice, you can rein in the urge to fight against every single thing they say. Keep quiet for a bit and listen. Show them that we can listen. Just showing that we are a happy and gracious bunch would be its own little victory, as it would be harder for them to claim that atheists and sceptics are all grumpy and horrid. At the end of my course, I've made some new Christian friends, despite not relinquishing any of my atheism. They even said that they wished every group had a sermon on it. To talk with them, listen to them, and tell them what you reckon. Using this simple formula, we can turn the Alpha Course into something truly valuable for our fellow humans, and it won't cost us a penny to do it. So go on the Alpha Course and be good.
Okay, so I was saw the Alpha Course. It actually reminded me, because I've been trying to set up a regular course for people who like insects. I was going to call it the Beta Course because there's a few bugs in it. I'm so sorry. It's like a really clever woman in the downstairs doing clever stuff. Anyway. Okay, so next, let's move on. And next up, let's hear from... Who should we hear from next? Is Deborah in the room? Brilliant, Deborah's back. Okay, so let's hear from Deborah, who was recently on Radio 4 talking about this, so she knows what she's talking about. And hopefully, that, you know, and we'll give her more than, you know, the 30 seconds she probably got as two people shouted at each other. So, here's Deborah Hines with an intriguing story of blasphemy.
University professor Dr. Deandra Poole has been placed on leave for his own safety after a classroom exercise during which it appears students were invited to write the word Jesus on a piece of paper and then tread on it. The idea that objects can contain essences, even sacred ones, is well established. Medieval churches, after all, did a roaring trade with relic tourism, and people rubbed Buddha bellies for good luck. Psychology professor Paul Rosin invites audience members to wear a certain cardigan, and many do. When told the knitwear belonged to Hitler, it didn't. Far fewer people accept the offer of modelling the tainted garment. It seems we have a natural sense of contamination, which it's been theorised has evolved as an adaptive trait relating to disgust, and thus helps us to avoid disease. This sense seems promiscuous enough to become attached to symbols and objects. On Sunday morning, last Sunday morning, I was invited to discuss the furore around Dr. Poole's suspension on Radio 4 Sunday. The discussion was fair, but as always with broadcast media, the time was short, and as a result, we weren't able to go deeply into the background of this case. It seems that Dr. Poole himself is Christian, that the exercise has been conducted many times before without attracting comment, that it's a recommended exercise from a recognised textbook, that there was a complaint from only one student, there was the possibility that that student may have been threatening or inappropriate, and that that student had, in response to a complaint about that behaviour, engaged a conservative Christian advocacy group, the Liberty Institute. Hurt feelings are one thing, but Dr. Poole's safety has been threatened in a way that must be very chilling to any African American. One email has suggested he might find himself hanging from a tree, for example. And given that Dr. Poole is on a one-year-long contract and doesn't have tenure, his professional life has probably been affected too. There's been a petition to get the professor fired, but a huge amount of support from the community and the faculty. The class apparently did not involve mandatory stepping on the paper or stomping on Jesus, as it was reported in some places. The idea, said Dr. Poole, was to conduct an exercise in symbolism, an exercise to show the power of symbols in American society. Undoubtedly, there are people who would gratuitously offend simply because they can get away with it, and that's unpleasant to watch. But the danger of giving redress for religious offence is that we need to get to a situation, is that we would get to a situation where people could control other people's conversations with how wounded they're prepared to be. You could wonder how Florida Atlantic's untenured professors will proceed from here. People in fear very rarely go right up to the line. Unless the university stands up for Dr. Poole, there'll probably be liminal areas where teachers are now afraid to go, and that's not appropriate for an academic institution. Not to mention that a college student who doesn't want his sacred cows challenged is probably wasting his time and money. It's chilling to realise that people can suffer real harm for discussions which potentially involve offence. The UK has laws which prevents actual crimes against people or their goods, and the Racial and Religious Hatred Act 2006 makes it a criminal offence to incite hatred against someone due to their religious or racial background. Most importantly, this is about hatred towards people and not towards ideas. It's worth remembering that heliocentrism, the idea that the Earth revolves around the sun, was considered probably in classical times and was reintroduced in the early modern era by German-Polish cleric and astronomer Nicholas Copernicus in 1543. His book attracted little controversy, not much and not immediately. In fact, it was dedicated to Pope Paul III. It was another 60-ish years before the book was suspended in 1616. So why the delay? History remembers the story of one of Copernicus' champions, an astronomer and philosopher named Galileo. He was instructed by the Inquisition not to hold or broadcast his heliocentric ideas, a request with which he initially complied. When finally invited to publish the comparison between the two models, his work became grounds for his trial for heresy in 1633. He was found guilty and spent the rest of his life under house arrest. Timing was a factor. During the Counter-Reformation, the Church protected its magisterium even more vigorously than before. But Galileo's personality has also been cited as a factor, and it's a valid point. He'd explicitly been invited to publish a comparison of the two celestial models, but seems to have made his own viewpoint clear in rather insulting terms. Perhaps he was attempting to trade on his good relationship with Pope Urban VIII, a bond which dissolved under such provocation. So it seems Galileo was a passive-aggressive pillock with poor social intuition. He was offensive, but he was also right. This story shows the truth doesn't always come in attractive packages. In a world where Sanal Edamaraku has had to leave India before his trial for blasphemy, in a world where at least 53 people, it's reckoned, have been killed in Pakistan since 1990 after being accused of blasphemy, and where a man can be imprisoned for 10 years in Thailand for insulting the king, it's worth treasuring our freedom of speech. Thank you.
Straight on, and let's now go to Elizabeth Donnelly, who's been training as a humanist celebrant. So, I don't know, is there something vicary I should say, like congregation now? Well, I don't know where I'm going with this. Here's Elizabeth Donnelly with more.
Thank you. Those of you who know me may be surprised to hear that I recently attended an aristocratic wedding. This is not due to a sudden abandoning of my trade union and working class roots, and nor was it an aspiration to finally join the class that I sound like. It's because the couple chose to have a humanist wedding, and I am a wedding and naming celebrant accredited by the British Humanist Association. On this occasion, I assisted my mentor with a hand fasting, where the couple joined hands at the end of the ceremony, and I tied them together with ribbons while they made commitments to each other. Once they released their hands, the knots in the ribbons remained, leaving a lasting memento reminding them of the promises they made. Not every humanist wedding includes a hand fasting. In fact, it's quite difficult to label a typical humanist ceremony because they're all unique, and that's what makes them so special. There is no set script, no prescribed mechanical mumblings, and no tuneless singing of hymns. If a couple want to light a candle, exchange garlands or roses instead of rings, or indeed have everyone sing Ying Tong Yid Lai Po, the Muppet version, then they can have that. Humanist ceremonies are all individually written by the celebrants with the couple and personalised to celebrate their union. Ceremonies often include how the couple met, their shared interests and details of the proposal. Some couples don't propose. I will be conducting a wedding in August where the couple agreed to get married over a long period of some months, and once they'd finally agreed it was probably a pretty good idea to wed, the groom asked if this was the point where he should buy an engagement ring and propose. And his bride responded, "I'm a feminist, it's not equal, so let's not." This point is so important to them, they've actually asked me to include it in the ceremony. Imagine going to a register office and being able to have the registrar write about how you met, your love for science and scepticism, or incorporate the naming of your child into the ceremony. Imagine going to a church or a mosque and having the same thing. Humanist ceremonies are also not confined to a particular place. The majority of humanist weddings are held outside, and civil weddings in England and Wales have to take place in a specifically designated room. It is the wish to get married in a place that is significant and special for a couple that brings a lot of them to the humanist website looking for a non-religious wedding. So with humanist ceremonies, you can have exactly what you want and where you want it, and that couple who didn't propose are having their wedding in a wine tasting venue. The ceremonies are very meaningful and emotional. The comment I hear most frequently following a humanist ceremony is how personal it was and how it truly reflected the people concerned. The aristocratic wedding was held in Scotland and was actually legally binding. Nearly half of all weddings and civil partnerships in Scotland are humanist ceremonies for this reason. Sadly, humanist weddings and partnerships are not yet legally recognised in England and Wales, meaning couples still have to go to a register office. An amendment was tabled in committee to the Marriage Equality Bill currently going through Parliament. It was defeated by a single vote from a Lib Dem. Another amendment has been made, and we are hopeful that it could be at least another 10 years before humane weddings are legal in England and Wales. We don't just conduct weddings either. Humanist funerals and maimings mean that secular people can have meaningful ceremonies for hatch, match or dispatch. Well, why should religion have the monopoly on ritual? Last week I was at a maimings training course and one of my colleagues said that maimings are the ultimate humanist ceremony. There is no impressing of religion on the child, just good wishes for the future and dedications to supporting the family. And what do we call the supporting adults chosen by the parents to help steer their child through life? Well, anything we like. Guide parents, odd parents, fairy godmothers, comrades, guardians, people of honour and distinction, and my personal favourite, awesome mentors. Humanist ceremonies vary in price from £140 to £190 for a funeral, £140 to £250 for a naming, and between £350 and £1,000 for a wedding. A percentage of the cost goes to the British Humanist Association to help further its ceremonies department, and you can find a celebrant on the BHA website at www.humanism.org.uk/ceremonies, or you can tweet me at LifeSceptic. Finally, I have a quote to share with you. I'm conducting a naming next week for a 2.5-year-old girl called Maya, and her parents have asked for this quotation from her namesake, Maya Angelou. I've learned that I still have a lot to learn. I've learned that people will forget what you said. People will forget what you did. But people will never forget how you made them feel. And that sums up humanist ceremonies in a nutshell. This is Elizabeth Donnelly reporting live for the Pod Delusion.
Thank you very much. Lib Dems, Lib Dums more like. Yeah, take that, Nick Clegg. Anyway, actually, what's the point of all here? Can you... Oh, this is really embarrassing. Put your hand up if you voted Lib Dem at the last election. Now keep your hand up if you're going to vote for the next election. Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. So, I'm just intrigued. I think we're that demographic, aren't we, of people who give up on them. Anyway, I'll stop. This is tedious for everyone, I know. Anyway, okay, so let's move on. And fine, now let's hear from Ben Hardwick, who's going to be talking about sharks and cancer. It's going to be carcinotastic. That doesn't listen. Here's Ben Whitmore. Thank you. Sharks have been with us for over 400 million years. They're among the oldest species on the planet, with a fossil record that's well before the first primates. Sharks fulfill many... Oh, not you. Oh, sorry. Sharks fulfill many roles in the ocean ecosystem, from the gill rakers, such as basking sharks and whale sharks, which feed on plankton, to apex predators, such as the great whites, which have been at the very top of the ocean's food chain, keeping it in check at the top for an almost inconceivable amount of time. However, this has all been thrown out of balance, as humans have overfished many species of sharks to near extinction. In fact, the populations of some species have declined by over 90% in just 3 decades. The primary driver for demand is undoubtedly shark fin soup, which has exploded in popularity following the rise of the Chinese middle class. Formerly the cuisine of the Chinese aristocracy, it's now considered a prestigious dish to serve at weddings and business banquets. However, there are plenty of other factors that contribute to the demand for dead sharks. There are good sources of squalene, for example, which is used in cosmetics such as lipsticks. As well as this, sharks have also found their way into alternative medicine. Medicine takes the form of pills, which are made from ground-up shark cartilage, a byproduct of the shark fin industry. The basic premise of the medicine is that sharks don't get cancer, so by consuming their cartilage, you're effectively taking on the power of the shark's immune system, giving you the ability to fight off cancer as well. But where does this idea that sharks don't get cancer come from? Why do people think that sharks don't get cancer? I did a lot of research into this, and some people believe that it's a part of traditional Chinese medicine, for example, with the link to shark fin soup. But the main source of the myth appears to be a book published in the early 1990s called Sharks Don't Get Cancer by Dr. I. William Lane. Lane was an American nutritionist who passionately believed in the power of natural remedies and claimed that the National Cancer Institute was biased towards studies that originated outside the establishment. He was a great believer in the power of the immune system and also wrote another book entitled Immune Power, How to Use Your Immune System to Fight Disease, from Cancer to AIDS.
In Sharks Don't Get Cancer, he cites many studies from his own research, which appear to back up his theory that consuming pills made from shark cartilage can cure cancer. On the surface, it looks like he makes a compelling case. The book features a whole chapter on the importance of clinical trials, for example, but further investigation reveals a different story. The product tested in the trials, called Benefin, is a product of Lane Labs, which is run by Dr. I. William Lane's son. None of the trials referenced in Lane's book, which were conducted on patients, cancer patients in Cuba and Mexico, were published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal either. Since the book's publication, several independent studies into the efficacy of shark cartilage as a cure for cancer have shown it to be no better than a placebo. Following this, in 1999, the US Food and Drug Administration pursued an injunction against Lane Labs for illegally promoting Benefin as a cancer treatment. Meanwhile, other scientists have taken it upon themselves to debunk the myth that sharks don't get cancer. In 2004, Dr. Gary Ostrander at the University of Hawaii conducted a study of cancerous shark specimens. His report, which was published in the Cancer Research Journal, revealed that 42 tumours have been shown in specimens of various sharks and rays, including some species with multiple tumours. It's not to say that there isn't some truth in the fact that sharks do have remarkable immune systems, which are generally more resistant to cancer than ours. Cartilage has few blood vessels and has anti-angiogenic properties, meaning it develops few new blood vessels that can deliver nutrients to cells which are necessary for the growth of tumours. Shark immune systems also have smaller antibodies than ours, which could potentially be useful in neutralising some tumours. However, this doesn't mean that you can cure any cancer simply by consuming a pill made of shark cartilage. As Dr. Ostrander concluded in his report, even if sharks are less susceptible to cancer, it is illogical to conclude that crude extracts of shark cartilage would be successful in curing cancer in humans. Yet the myth persists. The BBC Earth section of the BBC website recently ran an educational animal quiz for kids called Trick or Treat. It asked if sharks get more sick than any other animal, and the answer was trick. These fearsome predators have another string to their bow. They're the only animals that are immune to every single disease, including cancer. Tough cookies. Meanwhile, sharks don't get cancer or variations of that wording repeatedly churned out by amazing fact websites and Twitter accounts with no citations, often getting thousands of retweets, enabling the myth to spread further. The myth is also cited as fact in the Triviathon game too. It's what happens when perceived wisdom is passed on as fact without people asking if it's true. Sharks aren't the only Chondrichthyes species threatened by bogus medicine either. Very recently, manta rays have become very seriously threatened by a new Chinese medicinal tonic made from boiled manta gills. As with the logic behind shark cartilage medicine, where the theory is that consuming the shark cartilage passes the ability to fight cancer onto you, the manta ray gill tonic is also based on humans seeing patterns where they don't necessarily exist. In the same way that manta ray gills filled out plankton in the sea, the basis of the tonic is that it will filter out the toxins in your bloodstream. An investigation conducted by conservation charities including Wild Aid and Shark Savers revealed that the medicine was being sold as an immune system booster as well as a cure for fertility problems, chickenpox and again, cancer. There is of course no scientific evidence behind any of these claims. In fact, the manta ray tonic isn't even mentioned anywhere in a traditional Chinese medicine manual. There's not even anything traditional about it. The problem is that sharks and rays aren't large-scale shoalfish like cod and mackerel. They often take several years to reach sexual maturity and then have few young. A good local example for us is the spiny dogfish, sometimes called the spur dog. A female spiny dogfish takes 2 decades to mature, and then often only has 1 pup. Spiny dogfish are listed as vulnerable to extinction on the IUCN Red List, but are commonly available in UK fish and chip shops where they're sold as husk or rock, while the fins are often used in an economy form of shark fin soup. The explosion in demand for manta ray gills has already had devastating consequences as well. The oceanic manta ray largely disappearing from the Sea of Cortez in just a few years. Meanwhile, Dr. Shelley Clark's paper on the scale of the shark fin industry, based on large-scale statistics gathered at shark fin auctions in Hong Kong, which was published in Ecology Letters in 2006, estimated that humans kill a minimum of 26 million sharks a year and a maximum of 73 million. The median is around 38 million, which is generally accepted as the most likely figure at that time. The fact is that the shark species often targeted, such as scalloped hammerheads and blue sharks, simply won't be able to withstand this level of fishing for much longer before their populations collapse. There is hope, though. Just 2 weeks ago, Amazon in the UK pulled shark cartilage medicine from sale, and Holland & Barrett also stopped selling it in the UK a couple of years ago. This year, the EU also finally closed the loopholes in the law that allowed shark finning. This is the process where the shark's fins are cut off while it's still alive before dumping it back in the sea where it starves to death. This won't stop shark fishing, but it will reduce the scale of it. Several species of shark, including the oceanic white-tip and manta rays, were also given protection under sites this year, which limits their trade. There's still time to save sharks and rays, and public awareness and pressure really does make a real difference. If someone tells you that sharks don't get cancer, give them the facts to help prevent the myth from spreading. Tell people to avoid eating Castle Rock at the chip shop. They probably wouldn't do it if they knew it was a threatened species. And if you really want to help sharks, there are several great marine conservation charities that work hard to lobby politicians for greater protection of sharks and rays. In particular, we have the Shark Trust, sharktrust.org.uk, in this country, which has strict science-based policies and works hard to protect sharks. They also have a letter template on the website, which you can send to anywhere that you see selling shark cartilage medicine. By encouraging critical thinking, challenging misinformation, and supporting the hard-working people who work in conservation, there's a good chance that we could save these threatened species of sharks and rays from extinction and keep our ocean ecosystem intact. This is Ben Hardbush from the Pod Delusion at QED.
Is going to happen. So finally, we've got Liz Lookendorf, who's going to do a short piece about semantics. It's fine, she's going to be finished in time. If you don't want to listen about semantics, I will label you anti-semantic.
Yay!
Yeah. So, here's Liz, being quick.
I don't know if this is going to be interesting, contentious, or incredibly boring, so I apologise or take credit for everything. I unabashedly love science, kind of why I'm here as well. I also unabashedly love history, without so much thought, it's safe to assume that I love the history of science. Now, this might be an exercise in semantics, as James has said, but saying that I love the history of science is different than saying I love science history, in that there's a big difference between a scientist writing history, which has been the long tradition, and a historian writing about science, which actually doesn't have much of a tradition at all. It's a subtle difference, but one I hope to possibly persuade you into believing. I guess this sort of idea has been rolling about in my head for some time. There's been a few arrows shot between, you know, the underfunded humanity sector and scientists about the role of each, basically, in science. And despite what you might think about the importance of science funding or not, you should have a look at what cuts have done to the social sciences. As someone just beginning the journey of a PhD in history, it makes me wonder why they're even offering them anymore. Anyway, I slightly digress. Before I fell in love with science, I took a course in the history of medicine in my final year of my history. My final year of my history degree. To put that in perspective, my professor, who'd been newly appointed, was the first historian appointed in my university, which is one of the top five in Canada, to ever have that position. There was no history of science curriculum in my university. There was one 200 level course, which is a second year course, mainly for science students. I think this is what might have kicked off my whole interest in science after a long breakdown between high school physics and my degree. It was truly amazing. It was eye-opening and intellectual exciting thing to dive into. This is where I first came in to really understand germ theory, but not in the context of science, but in the changes of hospital practices. This is the first time I encountered midwives, but in the context of power struggles between doctors and hospitals and the not-so-structured older elements of medicine. I'm not upset that we have hospitals and professionalised doctors, but it's quite interesting to examine the vested interests involved. While the end result is no doubt good, the way we got them wasn't always with the most pure motivations. My paper for the course was on the change in frontline medicine in World War I and World War II, with primary sources coming from American ambulance volunteers who would write almost marketing copy as being volunteer corps. They needed donations to keep their entire American volunteer force going. And they wrote brilliant little things about becoming acclimatized to the front line and being almost annoyed by the whine of bullets whizzing by their heads. And then in comparison to that, I was reading sections on the Canadian military kind of medical corpus on frontline medicine. It's really interesting. And to see in the next few years is going to be fascinating because, of course, 1914 will get the top secret classification, will be taken off many records, including medical records from World War I. So our entire ability to assess World War I will change, and eventually World War II. But even earlier than fourth year, my second year mandatory course in American history, of which we had four professors, may I add, we read an amazing book called Summer for the Gods, which got a Pulitzer Prize in the history category on the Scopes Monkey Trial, which you may all know. It was the evolution trial in 1925 in Tennessee. I had vague ideas at the time that this was about evolution. And it was. But it wasn't a man theoretically being persecuted by the authorities for boldly teaching evolution. It was a concerted effort to launch a test case to overturn a recent law. The teacher, John Scopes, was a willing participant in a case financed by the American Civil Liberties Union. One of my more recent forays into science, note the phrase, was The Emperor of All Maladies, a biography of cancer, which maybe some of you have read. This too was a Pulitzer Prize winning book, but for general non-fiction, note the distinction of Summer of the Gods. Perhaps this is a trivial matter, a Pulitzer Prize is a Pulitzer Prize and is pretty damn good. Before I started reading this book, I had gone to my PhD introduction talk in my cohort of newly pressed PhD candidates, and someone there was going to do her PhD in the history of cancer. I asked her about the book and she had a very interesting reaction. She wasn't a fan. It had some big problems which she'd be exploring as part of her literature review for her degree. So when I finally picked it up, I did so with perhaps a more critical eye than I would have originally. And it's true, it doesn't really pass the sort of great men of science test in history. The book is full of men and a few women who borrow the knowledge we have today about the medical professionals, about how medical professionals diagnosed and treated cancer. It is a little bit about patient groups and some on charities, but it was really about the people in labs doing things in labs. It wasn't so much about the people who had cancer, which does, to my thought anyway, seem to be a big part of the history of cancer. I don't begrudge the fact that these scientists did do all that work, and it's great, but there are passages in that book which are truly horrifying depictions of cancer treatment. One in particular was radical mastectomies that makes me go like this, like the same way testicular cancer make boys do that. This was pioneered by Dr. Reed Halstead. This could involve the removal of the breasts, but often the chest wall, muscles, some lymph nodes, bones, and other bits around that area, I suppose. Halstead acknowledged the physical penalty of the operations, and I'll quote from the book here. The mammoth mastectomies permanently disfigured the bodies of his patients. With the pectoralis cut off, that pectoralis, yes, the shoulders caved inward as if in a perpetual shrug, making it impossible to move the arm forward or sideways. Removing lymph nodes under the armpit often disrupted the flow of the lymph, causing the arm to swell up with accumulated fluid like an elephant's leg, a condition he vividly called surgical elephantitis. Very pleasant images. Halstead and his followers championed this method up into the 1950s and 1960s. He has quite a bit of tech supported him, but the pressure groups pushing towards the more targeted therapies that were developed got very, very few in comparison. I suppose this is where the difference lies between the history of science and science history. Science history can be informative, entertaining, illuminating, and even horrifying, but it rarely, if ever, brings to light the whole truth. For what we need is the history of science, which fills in all the details not left by doctors and research scientists. One final book that is probably one for your must-read list, if it's not there already, is The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. That was never a story that perhaps would have been told from a science history perspective. It was almost a study in the chronic failure of the medical establishment to properly inform a whole family and their mother's medical history. The daughter of the immortal Henrietta Lacks didn't even know until Rebecca Skloot took her to a research lab where one of her mother's immortal cells was used for research, that it was even a cancer cell. That is the difference to a person with a limited knowledge of science made all the difference between the mother being somehow still alive and it just being a cancer cell. Each profession has their particular talents. There are bad historians, like there are bad scientists, I suppose. Some of the mudslinging that goes on between the groups could just be showboating, but there is a slight but subtle difference, but an important distinction if you want to understand why things happen in science and not just what and who did them. Anyway, perhaps this is an exercise in semantics, but I encourage you, if you're interested in the history of science, to be sceptical about the history books you read so you get the whole story, warts and all. This is the most important part.
Thank you very much. And that's just about it for the Podillusion. So we're going to wrap up very quickly. Thank you to everyone who contributed. Simon, Ben, Deborah, Elizabeth, Liz, Sean. Denise, everyone, you've all been amazing. Podillusion.co.uk, subscribe to the weekly show. It's amazing, I would say that, so don't trust me. That's it. Thank you very much, everyone. Yeah!
Thank you for listening to this special edition of the Pod Delusion recorded at QEDCon 2013. You can find links on our website to find out more about the Pod Delusion and more about QEDCon. And fingers crossed there'll be a QEDCon 2014 and they'll let us do something similar again. But for now, thanks for listening.